Welcome to the Home Class Movie Chat, the place to get into all things movies. We'll leave no genre untouched, from romance to horror, adventure to comedy, and everything in between. We'll cover the good, the great, the bad, and the can I please get the last 2 hours of my life back ones you really wish that you could forget. So grab your popcorn and soda, sit back, and relax. It's time for the Home Class Movie Chat with Kat and Paul.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Home Class Movie Chat. I'm your host, Paul, and as always, my wife and co-host, Kat.
Hey, everybody.
Oh, my goodness. We're doing a very different movie this time. I don't know. It was rather interesting we decided to do this one, the 1979 movie, The Amityville Horror.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, definitely a break from our normal, but we said we would cover all genres.
Yeah, we did. So that being said, we decided to do this one because I thought, well, I mean, we've only just finished watching it and we thought, well, okay, we've got a podcast we've got to do. And we have been throwing around the idea of doing a horror movie. And of course, I'm an absolute horror fanatic, as everyone would know. I managed to talk you into the Amityville Horror.
Well, it's just because we were watching it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so it wasn't dark yet, because that's one creepy movie.
Well, they did do a remake in the 2000s. And it's funny enough. Now, the original 1979 was with James Brolin. Right? People were saying, oh, maybe Josh Brolin was going to be, you know, and he was actually on the idea of he was going to be actually in that movie, but then they switched it to Ryan Reynolds. So I don't know. I thought it would have been probably good if maybe the father and son had been involved in the two Amityville Horrors, but
yeah, it would have been a nice continuity.
Yeah, but unfortunately, they never got that far with Josh Brolin. So it just became James Brolin. And a lot of women sit there and go, oh, James Brolin, oh, did it all right on that one.
Both of them, both James and his son Josh, are very handsome men.
Yeah, I must admit. James Brolin is still with Barbara Streisand, isn't he? Isn't she?
Yes, he is.
The longest time. I didn't know. That's a relationship that actually has lasted at the test.
That's one of the few Hollywood relationships that has actually lasted.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we are going to review the 1979 Amityville Horror, and it is a supernatural horror film directed by Stuart Rosenberg and starring James Brolin and Margot Kidder as a young couple who purchase a home haunted by a combative supernatural forces.
And also starring Rod Steiger as the priest.
Yes, it is.
Probably actually the biggest name in that film.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Margot Kidder was still, I mean, she was relatively new. She'd just done like Superman.
I think she was just coming off of Superman.
So she was really coming off of the original Superman. And I guess, I mean, James Brolin had a lot of movies under his belt by this stage anyway.
Yeah.
But Margot Kidder being the fact that she was, you know, and a lot of people were saying that she was not the best choice for this movie. I actually disagree. I thought she was actually pretty good as Kathy.
I actually thought she was very strong.
Yeah, she did very, very well. But you know how there are people saying, oh, she wasn't very good as far as being Lois Lane and stuff like that. But you know, I mean, I don't think
I liked her as Lois Lane.
So did I. I don't think there's anywhere in Hollywood that people could sit there and go, oh, well, I think that this person was perfect for this role or that role, you know. There's always some critic out there that will sit there and go, well, I didn't like her in this one or I didn't like him in that one.
I mean, it is a shame that she ended up having the issues that she did years later. But as far as this movie goes, I thought she was excellent.
Yeah, I enjoyed her, and I've always enjoyed this movie, and I've always enjoyed her portrayal as Kathy Lutz. So This film was actually based on the Jay Anson's 1977 book of the same name. The story is based on the alleged experiences of the Lutz family who bought a New York home in Amityville, New York, where the mass murder had been committed a year before.
No, technically it was not a new home, just new to them.
New to them, yeah. It was actually released in July 27th, 1979, 118 minutes it goes for, and the budget was only $4.7 million, but the return was $86.4 million.
So that actually makes sense because there wasn't a huge amount of special effects or anything in this movie.
No, not at all.
I think probably the flies was like the biggest thing.
And the blood.
The flies, the blood, and the breaking angel statue in the church.
Yeah. I mean, other than that, I mean, you know, you've got all the other little things that throw along with it, which is the doors opening and closing, stuff like that. But the real, you know, the real special effects, there wasn't a whole lot.
Yeah.
So in the early hours of November 13th, 1974, Ronald DeFeo Jr. murders his entire family with a shotgun at their home in Amityville, New York. So knowing a lot about this story. Now, first of all, Ronald DeFeo Jr. is actually dead. He died this year in March.
2021.
2021. He had been in prison. He was actually serving six consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. He's changed his story hundreds of times. When I say hundreds of times, he's changed his story quite a lot.
Yeah.
First of all, he was saying that he heard the voices in the house. And then he was saying that it was a mafia hitman that actually killed his family, that actually came into the house and made him watch his entire family slaughtered.
Well, they were saying that the executions were done, that the murders were done execution style.
Yeah. So he first said, oh, this person came into the house, tied me up, and then dragged me around the house and made me watch as my entire family was executed. There was no basis of that, although they did put him into protective custody, and they actually did go to find this so-called mafia boss who actually had a very, very airtight alibi that he was nowhere near New York on the night of the murders.
Yeah.
And then there was also the rumor, or what he said was, that he came home from work, was in bed, he heard a gunshot, and he got up, and it was actually his sister, Dawn, that had actually executed his family. On wrestling her with the gun, he accidentally turned the gun on her and killed her.
Which I would believe if she wasn't lying face down in her bed.
Exactly. Now, that's something that is very poignant in the story and also in the movie. Now, they did say in this movie the mother was the only one that was shot in the head. That was not correct at all. Every member of the family was shot execution style in the head. That means the children and the adults. The father was shot in the head. The mother was shot in the head. They're all laying on their stomachs.
And how many children? Four?
Four.
Yeah. And how old were the kids, do you know?
I believe the youngest was nine to the oldest, which was Dawn, which was 16.
Jeez.
And then there was the mother and father. Now, you know, yeah, with him saying, oh, no, Dawn was the one that killed them and I wrestled the gun out of her hand and killed her. Well, you don't go and kill someone and then put them in their bed face down.
Yeah, not to mention it would have been a very different blood splatter on the walls.
Exactly. And what had actually happened was that...
Man, I watch way too much Law and Order.
No, that's actually completely fine because actually is good for this one. But when he... apparently he went to have a shower, got dressed, went to work, went back home, then went into a bar and said that my entire family has been murdered. A couple of the patrons from the bar that night did go to the house and find the family that had been killed.
Wow.
That's when he came up with the idea of this mafia boss or this mafia hitman, and he was put under protective custody until obviously the police did break him and it was found that he was actually the one. But he's got no recollection of that night. Now, a lot of people said, well, he was under the influence of drugs and he was a drug addict. Methamphetamines, cocaine, heroin, he was heavily involved in that. So that could be, you know, something along the lines of he was, you know, in control of, you know, substances. But
yeah,
we don't know. He's dead. But as I said, it's not like the same story, like, you know, the sky is blue, the water is wet. 20 years later, can you tell me about the story? Yes, the sky is blue and the water was wet. He's changed his story so many times that the prosecutors and even the defendant, the defense attorney, they just have got no idea what the truth is. They he was put in for six life sentences.
Well, the thing I find interesting, and we were talking about this earlier, is that was it Ronald DeFeo?
Yeah, Ronald DeFeo Jr.
That he doesn't apparently remember anything of those murders.
No, he remembers nothing about that.
That it's almost like another entity took over his body and did it and then gave it back.
The funny thing is, like, you know, if you watch the second Amityville, there's another movie called Amityville 2, The Possession. And that's basically a prequel to this movie, okay? And in that, which takes so long to go through the movie, they decide to try and do the demonic possession sort of situation. In the situation with Ronald DeFeo, they never came up with that idea at all.
Really?
They never went through demonic possession. They said that he was hearing voices in the house and the voices told him to do it. But demonic possession was not, they didn't put it down as that.
Because if he, okay, let's just say for sake of discussion that he did commit these murders.
Yeah.
Okay, and he has been convicted of it, so that's a fairly safe thing to say.
Definitely.
But if he doesn't actually remember doing any of it, let's just say for sake of discussion that that's the truth, that he doesn't remember any of this, he would have had to have had some, like, I mean, okay, it's one of two possible scenarios. Either something else had taken over his body for a time, or like, you know, like a split personality even, or it was just so horrifically traumatic that he just wiped his own memory of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a way of looking at it. I think one of the biggest things is that the prosecutors were saying is that, you know, if he doesn't remember it, he was, as I said to you, he was heavily involved in drugs and alcohol. They were basically making that as the possibility that he was so high up on drugs and alcohol, he didn't remember he even did that. And it's not uncommon for people that abuse, you know, drugs and, you know, those sort of situations that they lose track of what happened. They lose parts of their memory.
Yeah, that's not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah. So they've said, well, you know, regardless of whether he thinks, you know, because what it was is that he always believed that his family were out to get him. And it wasn't the fact that the family were out to get him. They basically did everything they could for him. I mean, his father gave him a job and then never expected him to turn up, but gave him a paycheck every week.
Yeah.
You know, they bought him a car. They bought him a speedboat. They gave him money. It was ordered because he was such a troubled young man. And so, you know, he had no real, he had no real responsibility. It was basically he was there to earn a paycheck, which he never earned anyway. But his mother and father just kept giving him presents upon presents on the possibility that he was going to straighten his life out. And right. I think in that situation, it was more that he was living the life of privilege and abusing drugs and alcohol every which way. And that could have led to the fact that he was heard these voices and thought that his family was out to get him. Now, did Dawn take part in killing the family and then he killed her? Who knows? Yeah. No, there's only one person.
I kind of doubt that idea, though.
Yeah, but there's only one person in the world that knows, and that is him, and he's no longer here. But as I said, he's an unreliable witness. He's changed his story too many times. So the beginning of this movie, it basically shows you the silhouette of the house. There's rain and there's thunder and lightning, and you're hearing gunshots going off in each window. And it's basically Ronald walking through each bedroom of the house, slaughtering his family. Now, as they said in the movie, which was incorrect because they showed you about seven things down the track, that the mother was the only person shot in the head. No. Every member of the family was shot in the head, and they're all laying face down. They were not laying face up.
They're all shot in the back of the head.
In the back of the head, laying down, face down.
That is actually execution style.
It really is. But the movie does make a mistake immediately on that, because you see the father laying up, face up, eyes open with a gunshot. That wasn't correct at all. That was incorrect. And then, of course, when you see the police officers at the front door and they're like, oh, you know, give me a ballpark, you know, time this happened. He said, oh, 3:15. Well, the police were never called there until about 7:30 the following night, because Ronald got up, got dressed, had a shower, got dressed and went to work, finished work at 5 o'clock, stopped off at a bar. And he said he'd been calling his family or his family home all day. Yeah. He got home at 7 o'clock the following night. So it wasn't as quick as what it said.
Well, it's also interesting that they would say that, because pinpointing time of death is not that exact. They usually get it down at the most. They usually get it down within a couple of hours.
Yeah. 3:15 was too.
And precise. Especially in the 79. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. 74.
Late 70s.
Sorry.
They 74. Didn't have the technology to pinpoint it as accurately as they may be able to now.
Yeah. And the thing is that with the fact that this had happened, say it did happen at 3:15 in the morning.
Yeah.
The bodies were laying in there from 3:15 in the morning until about 7:30 the following night.
Yeah. So I mean, they still would have been able to have pinpointed the time of death based on lividity and everything else to within, you know, like say between 1 and 4 a.m.
Yeah.
It would probably have been more likely the range.
But 3:15 was just way too
positive. I watch way too many CSI shows.
So the movie turns to 1 year later. George and Kathy Lutz, a young married couple, move into the property. George appears not to be strong of faith, but Kathy is a Catholic in name at least. Yes, well, it is at least, because she's got three children from a previous marriage that she's living. They've just got married. Yep. So really, they're bucking the trend of the Catholic the Catholic
of being
ideal.
married. But did they ever actually say if she's divorced? Because I don't recall them saying if she was divorced or if her husband died.
No, she actually did get divorced before she met George.
Right, but I don't recall
It
them actually
doesn't say
saying
that.
that in the movie.
Doesn't say that in the movie at all. It doesn't actually give you an idea of what why Kathy and George are together. But I mean, anyone that knows the story knows that Kathy did divorce
Yeah,
her
but
previous husband.
I did. It did make me smile when George was messing with the realtor when she's like, "Oh, and if you're looking at having a family, there's lots of room." And he's like, "Oh, we already have a family, two boys and a girl." And she's like,
I know. And it's almost like out of wedlock,
Yeah,
you know?
exactly. It's like,
But I
yeah.
mean, I understand in 79, you know, that was really not the thing to do.
Well, that's the thing is, we're coming out of the 60s, which is the era of free love. So it's a lot more accepted that men and women are having relations outside of marriage, but there's still a lot of judgment around that, especially in the more conservative communities. And Long Island is probably one of the more conservative areas of New York.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I look at that house. I mean, okay, this is another thing that people have to understand. And please, if you want to go and watch this movie, by all means, go and watch it. And I'm not saying don't, because I think it's a great movie, and it's got a lot of jump scares, and it's very creepy, and you know, it's great to watch. But
Just don't watch it in the dark.
no, definitely watch it in the dark. Definitely
No.
have to watch it in the dark. There is some there. I'm telling you, you got to watch it in the dark.
Only if you want to have nightmares.
No,
You
my
see red floating
cousin,
creepy eyes at 3:15 in the morning when you get up to pee.
no. My cousin and I were, I mean, I haven't seen her in well over 25 years, but her and I were real horror. We are horror fans, as far as I know, horror fans. We would go to video stores back in the day. You could go to video stores, and we'd make a hightail straight into the horror section. My other cousin would be sitting there, and he hated horror movies. So we would be sitting up until, you know, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning watching horror movies, and he'd take himself to bed about 10 o'clock at night, because we'd be up watching all these horror movies. But there is something to be said with all the lights being turned out, watching horror movies in the dark. It gives another thing of realism. But what I was going to say is that this movie, the way they've actually got the house stationed or positioned, it didn't have that much land around it. It's basically the house, and where you see, and when you watch this movie, as the realtor walks them up to the front door, there's a red door. Well, that area where they walk up, there's already a driveway there. So you've basically got the garage at the back, then you've got the house, a driveway that runs right alongside of the red door, and the next door, you've got a next door neighbor, and then on the opposite side, the next door neighbor as well. So they've tried to make this movie unrealistic for as far as where the house was situated. It was not in the middle of nowhere.
It admittedly, it plays better to the story if it feels more isolated.
Oh, it does. But when
So
you look,
I'm not going to get on them for taking that bit of poetic license.
no,
That's
I'm not. I'm
fine.
certainly not getting on them for that. I think it was great, but I just think that now, when you look at the house and how close the house was, it was never out in the middle of nowhere, you
Yeah.
know, which I found really interesting. She has three children from her previous marriage: Greg, Matt, and Amy. The couple turn to Father Delaney to quickly bless the home, but Delaney encounters troubles in trying to bless the home, including a room full of flies out of season, violent stomach sickness, and later blisters on his palms when trying to make a phone call to Kathy about their home.
Yeah, this poor priest. And I have to admit, the scene with the flies in that room was so painful to watch. I hate
Okay,
flies. I can't, I
so
hate it when they get in my face.
right, so Rod Steiger, when they were doing this movie, they were trying to work out what would actually attract flies to a person, right?
Well, either honey or literally crap.
Right, so what they did is, in this scene, when you see him sweating, what they did is they coated his face and it wasn't all over the face, it was just in certain blotches, a clear like clear syrup,
Corn syrup.
like corn syrup, but something very, very sweet
Yeah,
that
corn
actually
syrup
flies,
is.
right? So when you see him
Like
going to
Karo
open
syrup.
yeah so when you see him going to open up the door, like the window, to let the flies out, you see all the flies in that area. They'd coated the window with this syrup, and that actually let these flies out. So when you see his hand against there trying to open it up, and it's basically the outline of his hand, that's where he'd actually already had some syrup, and they'd made it so that every part of the window was covered except for that small part. And on the backside of his hand, they put the syrup on there. So when he was opening it up and he took his hand away, that's where the flies were most concentrated. So you saw them, you know, in that area.
Yeah.
But when they got them to fly onto his face, they'd actually put dots, and I think it was about 30 dots of this syrup on his face, put him into this room, and they closed it all off. So they only had the cameraman, the lighting person, whatever, and they let the flies out, and the flies immediately went to the two spots, went to the window, which was the main concentration, and him. So he had to literally had to sit there with all these flies on him.
Ugh, I don't know how he could stand it.
They were clean flies. They were actually bought from a lab, and they were actually clean flies that they were actually using. So there was no disease that these flies were carrying.
I don't care. They're still just gross.
Yeah, but it was the fact they had to have him fly over the place. Now, what I was saying to you during this movie, that now there was obviously the Father Delaney is not his real name.
Yeah.
I do remember, I think I remember his last name.
Doesn't matter.
Messino, I think it was. But anyway, the priest that actually was involved in the Amityville house, he said that when he got to the house originally, he was supposed to bless the house, but Kathy and George weren't home.
So if they're not home, how is it that he just goes walking into the house and wandering around upstairs?
Right. No, weren't home, they weren't home in the house. They were attending to something out the back.
Yeah, but and why didn't he just walk around the house? I mean, who just walks into somebody's house?
Well, I guess he was expected, but the fact is that he knocked on the door and pushed the door open, and the door was open. So he was already invited in.
Yeah, I know, but seriously, would you just walk into somebody's house like that?
I would have just sat there and knocked on the door, and if I got no response, I would have done what you said. Walked around the house to try and find where they were. Yeah. But
I wouldn't just walk into somebody's house and then walk upstairs and start looking around.
He'd been a family parish priest for many years. And so when they bought the house, they asked him to bless the house, he got to the house, he was expected, but of course, when he opened up the door, he said that he thought they were in the kitchen. He went into the kitchen, they weren't there, then he heard a noise upstairs. So he thought they were just doing something upstairs. Now, this is where it gets a little bit hazy, because he said he went up into the first room, which was what they call the sewing room. Now, the sewing room was a room that was going to be just for Kathy to do her arts and crafts, her painting, and her sewing. So she would have that all set up. He went into the room to begin with, and he wanted to start the blessing from there and move through the house. He'd already said to Kathy that, you know, he was going to be doing this on a certain day. Now, I don't know. This is where I'm not really, really 100% sure of what had actually happened. But with what he said, he went upstairs. He took his purple stole out. He put that on. And he was about to do his blessings of the house. The door did shut, but he said the amount of flies that were in the room was not as excessive as the movie that you see in the movie.
Okay.
But there were flies in the room, and it was cold. It was a cold New York day, so there was no flies supposed to be there. He said the temperature did go up quite a lot in that room, and he was having a hard time.
What time of year was this? Do you remember?
This would have been going on late September, October.
Okay, so we're definitely moving into fall. So yeah, flies should not have been generating around that time.
Yeah, but he said that the room got extremely hot, like was almost like he said that someone had turned on a furnace in there and just cranked it. Now, this was something that was left out of the movie, but unfortunately, they should have actually put it in. That would have been more impactful.
Yeah.
But he was starting to do his blessings in the room. Now, he actually started to say his blessings in the room.
Mm-hmm.
The smell in the room got very, very rancid in the room. And then he was hit across the face, like hard.
Wow.
The point that actually knocked him off his feet and onto the ground. He got up, and the door actually swung open after it closed. And there was it was a demonic voice telling him to get out of the house. So in this scene, exactly what you see in this movie is exactly what did happen.
With the exception of him not getting
hit. With the exception of him not getting hit. But he said that he was hit with such a force that it knocked him off his feet onto the ground. He did get out of the house. A lot of the things that he went through, like the blisters on his palm, that actually did happen. He went to make a phone call to Kathy. He actually had to drop his phone because it was so hot. and there was like blisters of like stigmata on his hands. He could never get through to Kathy. He could never get through to the house. It was always static interference.
I kept expecting him to try to go back.
He did. He did try to go back. There was a scene where him and another priest into a car to drive back.
And the car crashed.
The car did crash. So basically, he just couldn't get back there to warn Kathy. Now, even, you know, in certain situations, he was very much affected by this. And he didn't leave. And he wasn't a psychotherapist. That's the whole thing. They were saying that he was a psychotherapist. He wasn't. He was just a regular priest. He dabbled a little bit in psychotherapy, but never went the entire distance of being a doctor. But he was having a large amount of trouble to try and get back to this house. He was never able to, and he suffered quite a great deal. And also, there was a scene in the movie, which we'll get to, that never happened either.
We'll talk about that.
More impactful. So the experience eventually stops when the door is open and the voices whisper, "Get out," and it does. And it's a very demonic get out. I mean, you know, basically get the hell out of this house.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, I mean, I don't care who you are. I mean, whether you think you're tough or whatever. If you've lived in a haunted house or in a house that is with an entity like I have, you tend to go with what they say. And it's not as fun as what you think it would be. And it's not as impactful and in joyful when you've got these things going around the house.
I
remember, just touching on it just briefly, I remember a certain situation that my mother said to me, "I've got to go and take your father down to the train station. I'll be back in a minute." Would have been 15-20 minutes, and I was alone in the house during the morning before I went to school, and I was up in my bedroom just doing something, and between the doorway and myself there was heavy breathing in the doorway.
That's creepy.
Yeah. And I was the only person in the house.
Where was your sister?
My sister went with mum in the car.
Oh, okay.
I decided to stay home. And this was about 8:30 in the morning, and I'm in my room and this thing is breathing, heavy breathing in between my doorway and me.
That's a bit creepy.
Yeah. So it's not as fun as what people think. So so what happens is that Rod Steiger is basically told to get out of the house. He does get out of the house. does he get out of the house? He rushes out of the house when the voice yells at him, and he decides to continue helping the family, the Lutz family. He can't really help the family at all.
Yeah.
The amount of times he tried to actually get back to the family or make phone calls, it was not going to have it.
That's just so sad.
Because I think basically the demonic entity that was in the house was making sure that no contact between Kathy and George and Father Delaney was ever going to happen again. I don't know. See, this is the whole thing, and even what you said, you know, this thing wants you out of the house but wants to keep you in the house with no contact with priests or whatever. I mean, even when Kathy's aunt comes to the house, and she happens to be a nun, she walked into the house and had to walk straight back out again. She couldn't stay for, she was going to go there and you know, bring a pot plant for the new house and have a cup of tea and enjoy herself and visit with Kathy. And even she walked in and went, "Nope, I got to get out of this.
Can't do it." Yep.
So Delaney is later involved in a car accident resulting from a mysterious malfunctions, and he becomes frustrated at the lack of support from his superiors in the diocese.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that for a second.
Yes.
And this is by no means a condemnation of the Catholic Church.
We're not trying to be controversial on this podcast, but there is some glaring problems.
Well, I just find it really interesting that they want you to believe and have faith in things that cannot be seen. They have the doctrine of transubstantiation, which means that when they administer the sacrament, the wafer becomes the literal body of Christ and the wine becomes the literal blood of Christ during the sacrament. But yet, if you go to them and say there's something demonic happening, they're the first ones to poo-poo you and not believe you.
And once again, I hark back to my experiences with what we had in our house for 7 years, and everyone was affected by it, but more so my mum was affected by it because it centered around her. My mum could not work out where to go. I mean, she went to mediums, she you name it, she went to faith healers that put magic rocks on the stairs in our house to try and get rid of things. What's the first thing that you would do if this was happening to you? Where would you go?
Yeah, I probably would try to go to and talk to a priest.
The first place would be to go to a priest. So my mum went to a priest and went to the church and said, "I am in deep pro we've got deep problems in our house. Where I'm in trouble. This is what's happening." And the Catholic Church wiped their hands of my mother and said, "Sorry, can't help you." Now, this is somewhere where you would think, that we've got things all over, all over the world. We've got if you've got, domestic problems, you go to a police officer. If your house is on fire, you go to a firefighter. If you've got medical problems, you go to a doctor and a nurse.
If
If
your
you've got
house is
spiritual,
possessed, you go to a priest.
you go to a priest. Now, out of everyone that I've mentioned, three out of the four will actually help you. The fourth one doesn't want anything to do with you, and that's the priest. And this is why, and I'm not trying to be controversial because I went to Catholic school, so I know what I'm talking about. But the thing is that they, exactly what you said, they want you to, believe in God and Jesus and his apostles and angels. But yet, when something as so serious as either a spiritual infestation in your house, they basically go, "Nope, sorry." The only people that actually managed to get rid of what was in our house was actually spiritual mediums. Three spiritual mediums my mother found who came and actually cleansed the house and got rid of what we had. And it wasn't through anything to the Catholic Church. It was these people that had enough faith in themselves and said to my mother, "We believe you." And the way that it actually happened, and I'll just touch on this briefly before we go back to the movie, is that my mother was working with my father in his business here in South Australia, and my mother was talking to someone, and it just so happens to was a lady that she knew, and the table right next to her was these three people. And the lady tapped my mother on the shoulder and said, "We can help you." And my mum first said, "Yeah, sure you can." And she said, "No, seriously, we can help you. We've dealt with this before. We can definitely help you." And my mother, to the day that she passed away, swore that these people were the ones that actually helped her. And from the moment that they helped my mother and our family, we had no problems. So I do feel that the Catholic Church needs to stand up and take a little bit of responsibility when people do come to them and say, "We've got a problem."
Well, not just that, but if you want them to believe in the good, you have to accept the existence of the evil.
Yeah, and I think that comes along with the new movie that's out now called Conjuring Part
My
3.
God, get out of my head. I was just
Yeah.
thinking about that scene
Yeah.
where they're in court
Ed
and he's
Warren.
like, every time somebody swears an oath on the Bible to tell the truth, you're admitting the existence of God. So why is it so hard to admit the existence of evil?
Exactly. And that's why I think that the Catholic Church should actually say to people, when you've got a problem like this, yeah, we can help you. We've got the tools.
Well, I guess they just don't want to be Ghostbusters.
Exactly. he ultimately lo appears to lose faith. It says here, becoming blind. He never became blind.
Oh, really?
Yeah, never did.
Oh, okay. Because I was actually going to ask if we knew if we ever regained his sight.
No, he never went blind to begin
Oh,
with.
okay. I love
And
how
he
much you know about the backstory of this movie.
now I'm sorry.
Don't apologize. It's interesting.
He said he did lose his faith, and he did have a mental breakdown,
Yeah, I
but
believe
he never
that.
went blind. He said that the book was the movie made him blind. The book certainly didn't, because he never became
All right,
blind.
so they took a little artistic license.
They really did, but it yeah. I found that to be really really interesting, because there he is explaining to the other priests, and I remember he said, "What I felt was real. What I experienced was real. There's a family that's in trouble, and I need to help them." And of course, they come up with the old idea of like, "Do you think that you've got the know-how of everything that goes on? We've experienced these things, and we don't believe in the devil and stuff like that." And I think at that stage, he was Father Delaney, and I can't, as I said, it's the other priest's name, but anyway, he was certainly trying to, he wanted to help them. He just didn't know how, and he didn't have the tools to do so. And he really needed someone to stand up with him and say, "Okay, you've got a family in your parish that's in trouble. Let's help them."
Let's at least investigate what's going on. But it just shows you the bureaucracy is a time-honored tradition that just nothing really changes, where you're like, I have this family in my parish that needs help. There is something very wrong here, and we need to find out what it is and see how we can help support these people. And the bureaucrats are like, yeah, we think you need to go on a vacation. Why don't you go visit your family?
Yeah, and while you're gone, this will go away and you would forget all about it.
Yeah.
And this is why even in part two of this, of the Amityville Horror, you know, one of the priests wants to do an exorcism on the young boy who believes he's possessed, which is supposed to be Ronald DeFeo. And so he goes to the archbishop and or goes to a higher priest and says, you know, I want to do this. And he goes, well, do you want to do the exorcism yourself? And he goes, you know, yes, I do. And he goes, well, the archbishop wants to talk to you about this situation, but we will take our time and just basically sit and wait, and we will think about if we decide to do it. They're not going to rush into anything. And I understand that they want to actually investigate in the possibility of ruling out mental illness or drug dependency or stuff like that. But if you rule out everything else and it comes down to the fact that this person is possessed or something going on, you need to help them, man.
Yeah.
But exactly. They don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So Kathy's aunt, a nun, comes to the house one afternoon but becomes violently ill. Does she ever?
Yeah,
because she walks into the house because what actually happened, and once again, I know way too much about this movie. So the aunt was a nun, and she was coming to the house, and before she got there, all the toilets backed up, and as Kathy said in an interview, it was just basically black sludge.
Yeah,
that was coming out of the toilet, and I think it was basically the house was expelling basically to make sure that, because she said the smell was rancid through the house. They had four toilets in the house, and every toilet, when you flushed it, became this black sludge that was coming out of the house. Yeah. So it was almost like the house was repelling what she was, that this another spiritual person was coming to the house.
Yeah.
So she was just trying to make sure that this person didn't come in. When her aunt did come to the house, she actually stayed a little bit longer than what was actually did in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
She did come into the house. She said she had feelings about the house, that something didn't want her in that house. But she did say that the calmest place was the kitchen. Mm. And this is something that I mentioned to you today. Kathy always used to say that the kitchen was the most welcoming part of the house. And those times that she actually felt there was something in the house, it was a very warm, calming, almost like an elderly lady. There was a very warm and welcoming person in that space.
Yeah.
She said her favorite place in the house was the kitchen. She never felt cold in there. It was always decent temperature. And she just felt like it was very, as Kathy said, it was very light and airy in that kitchen. There was no heaviness in the house. She said she would go to other parts of the house and there was this heaviness that would follow you. But that kitchen, as soon as she crossed the threshold from wherever she was into the kitchen, that heaviness lifted. And it was a lovely area. So the nun actually did make it into the kitchen and did feel that nice, airy sort of like heaviness gone. But she did cross back into the house or back into the main part of the house and did feel the heaviness.
Yeah.
And that's what made her leave. She just said, I'm not feeling well. I've got to go. It wasn't as quick as the movie portrays it. She walked in, gave her the pop plant, and I've got to get out of here.
Yeah, that being said, the movie didn't need for her to be there longer.
No, it didn't. And she was she was basically useless.
I mean, honestly, I wish that they would have cut the sex scene that short, because that was as unnecessary to the story as the nun being there.
That being said, Kathy always used to say when she was in the house that there was a feeling in the bedroom of like eroticism. Like she just, it was not, because it was almost like that there were... No, I'm not trying to say there wasn't enough sex in that room, but she always had an overwhelming sense of lust and affection in that room. So I think what the movie was trying to get at is that you know, she was lusting after George. She wanted to be physically intimate with George, and that was the room. And like mostly all bedrooms, you know, they do have an air of eroticism in a lot of bedrooms.
That did not come through. It just came across as, yeah, okay, we get it. They're newlyweds. Can we move on now?
Yeah, I mean, she did. It did lend itself to a lot. It was a long and drawn out sex scene.
Yeah, it was really unnecessarily long.
But I always remember watching that movie and seeing the door open, and I'm like, oh shit, the door's opening. What is it? And then Amy standing there going, I want to go home.
Yeah,
and it's like, oh. And even you said, hang on a minute. She was dressed. Kathy was dressed in like a white shirt. Now she's got George's plaid shirt on all of a sudden. But I think what had happened is at some stage while they were getting it on, she disrobed. And then when the door opened, she was just lucky enough, just quick enough to grab something and put over herself to take Amy back to bed. But Amy also had problems in the house, which we'll get to, because she always had this little friend called Jody. Now, George did say that the final night when he was walking back from the boathouse, he looked up to the second floor and he said he saw a pig, a very large pig in the bedroom, in one of the windows. So whether Amy was actually seeing a little girl called Jody, or a pig or whatever, it gave different views to everyone. Everyone experienced different things. George begins to become more sullen and angry over a perceived cold in the house and obsesses with splitting logs and keeping the fireplace stoked. This is actually true. Once again, George could never get warm in the house. This is a very, very big fireplace. And he was always, wherever he was in the house, he was always cold, whether it was in his bedroom or down. It was just a cold feeling that he was just following him. Kathy had no problems in the house. And as I said, when she said she'd get into the kitchen, there was a nice, open, airy, warm feeling in that kitchen. She was always warm in the house. George couldn't get warm. So I think it's the manifesting of the entity that was actually dealing with George in a different way that it was dealing with Kathy and dealing with the other children. Yeah. But he could never get warm. So he was having the roaring fireplace. And he was basically, he would say he could actually sit on the, like right at the edge of the fireplace and put his hands in, you know, as if trying to get warm, and he couldn't get warm. It just was not hot enough. It was just not big enough to keep him warm because this thing was affecting him in such a way.
Yeah.
Before Kathy's brother's engagement party one night, 1500.
No, it was for the wedding.
Oh, that's right. His wedding. That's right. To be used for a caterer inexplicably. Yes, I thank you, my dear. Goes missing in the house. So somewhere in the house is $1,500.
Yep.
So in this scene, they're talking about he's continuously counting out this money because the caterer says he wants cash. He doesn't want a check. He wants cash. So basically back in the 70s, cash was king. There was no such thing as, obviously there was credit cards and things like that, but
it was either cash or personal check for the most part.
No. Well, yeah, but he doesn't want a personal check. Yeah. And he's like, I don't want a check. I want cash. So there's the brother counting out the money. And of course, Kathy comes in. George is looking like shit. I mean, he is looking really bad. I don't know why. I know he was supposed to be his best man, but he looks terrible. And he really needs to go back to bed, But of course, George being George, he decides to soldier through. So the brother's counting out the $1,500 and puts
it. Well, it's his brother-in-law. He doesn't want to let him down.
Yeah, that's understandable. So he counts out the $1,500 and he bundles it up and he puts it into his jacket pocket. Now, Kathy doesn't go anywhere. George doesn't go anywhere. The brother doesn't go anywhere. They're all in the same room, in the living room. The babysitter comes in to say, because the kids aren't going. Amy's not going because she's been unwell.
Yeah, the boys go.
The boys are going, but Amy's not well, so she's staying at home with the babysitter. So the babysitter just says, I give her an aspirin before she goes to bed. Yep, okay, and she leaves. So,
oh my God, is it me or does the babysitter remind you of Carly from The Incredibles?
Oh my God, she does.
Yes, yes. with the teeth thingy and the it's Carly.
Yeah, with the full mouth braces.
Yeah, because it's like I'm sitting here going, I know this look, and it's Carly from The Incredibles when she was babysitting Jack.
Yeah, yeah. Now I can see that.
Sorry,
she's got the braces and she's got the headgear that she needs to put on.
And the red hair and ponytail.
Red hair and ponytails. So she barely walks into the room. So she walks out. So you're watching her. So no one's gone near this jacket. And this jacket is just slung over the chair.
Yep.
The young boys, they've been tying some cans on the back of the groom's car and they're beeping the horn. And of course, George being the fact that he's sick and when everyone's sick, they're always very, testy and very angsty and cranky about it. And he's like, get those bloody kids off the horn. So he goes, okay, so we've got to go because we're going to be running late. The brother picks up the jacket and starts looking for the $1,500 because he is so anal about it because it is back in 79, $1,500 was quite a lot of money.
Yeah.
And this was for the whole caterer for the entire wedding. So he looks and he's like, okay, I'm missing $1,500. Now, they haven't gone anywhere. No, they haven't moved from this room. Yeah. No one's touched the jacket.
But the money has vanished.
The money's vanished. So somewhere in this house is $1,500. Yep. Nobody knows where, but it disappears. And that's something that is very nerve, you know, it makes you very on edge, because suddenly you got $1,500. It's just suddenly disappeared that you actually had, you know, set aside. It's very, very creepy. Meanwhile, the babysitter watching Amy for the evening is locked inside the bedroom closet by an unseen force. This is terrifying.
And can't get out.
Can't get out.
And so, then it turns the light out on her.
Yeah. So the young girl, she goes to, she's, you know, Amy's in her bedroom, and she says, well, I've got to give you an aspirin for you to go to bed. And she's like, oh, well, I'm not really sick. I just didn't like meatloaf. And she goes, well, listen, you've still got to get in your pajamas because you've been sick. So I'm going to go and get your pajamas. So she goes into the closet, and the young girl looks over her shoulder as if someone's standing right near her. And then the door slams shut. Of course, Amy's sitting on the bed, and even you said, what the hell is wrong with this kid? Like, you know, she looks like she's in a daze. The rocking chair starts rocking because this is, you know, Miss Jody is the one that's controlling everything. And this poor girl cannot get out, and she's really banging on this door, and she's becoming absolutely petrified about what's going on. So she's
it's like hysterical because she's I don't blame her for being claustrophobic in that situation if you can't get out.
No. But the thing is that between the closet and the bed, it's two steps away from it. So really, Amy could have easily gone and opened up the door. So there's this young girl, you know, banging on the door saying, Amy, I'm in the closet. Can you open up the door? And then, of course, there's no response. So she's, you know, trying to open up the door, and the door is stuck. I mean, it's like it's locked. It seems like it's locked.
Yeah.
This girl is becoming more and more panicked. She's banging on the door. Her knuckles are now bloody because you can see how much she's banging on the door. And, of course, you get an exterior shot of the house. The bedroom light goes out. The young girl is still banging madly on the door.
The closet light goes out, not the bedroom light.
No, the bedroom light where Amy's sleeping goes out.
Oh, I didn't see it.
She's going to sleep. The closet light's still on. This girl's banging on the door saying, Amy, open up the door, please. The light goes out, and that's where this blood-curdling Amy comes from. You can hear it in her voice that she is just terrified. It's almost like something is right in that room and she's seen it.
Yeah.
Screams at the top of her lung to try and get out of this room. This poor girl, she's been in the room for what would be possibly maybe three and a half hours George and Kathy are still at the wedding at this stage, and George is basically hassled in the men's room because, hey, there's no cash. I need cash for the wedding. And he's like, well, there's no cash, but I'll write you a personal check. And he goes, yeah, well, hang on. The caterer's
the deal
like,
was
well,
for
the deal was for cash. Yeah, I'll tell you about checks. Checks bounce. Checks are not cash. Cash is cash.
Stopped, yeah.
And of course, George is looking really sick, and he's like, if you don't take the check, you're going to eat your own goddamn food.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, I better back off because this guy's getting really pissed at me, so I'm going to get the hell out of here. So, you know, they take the kids and they go home. This poor girl, she's still in the closet banging away to try and get... Luckily, George and Kathy hear her from downstairs, run up into the bedroom, turn the bedroom light on. There's Amy's asleep. She's having a great time. And George opens up the door, and I understand this girl precisely. You know, I've got no problems with her when she rushes over to Amy and goes, why didn't you open the door? You know, I'm almost like wants to go and smack the living shit out of this kid.
Yeah, don't blame her.
No. And she's like, you know, the door wouldn't open. And of course, George goes, hang on a minute, and goes in the closet, closes the door, then opens it completely, no problems, and goes, there's no lock on the door. Yeah. And this girl's like, it wouldn't open. It was locked. I could not get out. And he's like, it's impossible. This door does not have a lock. It can't lock by itself.
And then Kathy looks at Amy and says, why didn't you open the door? And she says, well, Jody told me not to.
Jody wouldn't let me.
Yeah.
And of course, then George does yell, because looks at, does say, you know, who's Jody? And she goes, oh, Jody's my friend who comes to visit me. And George is like, why are we standing around listening to this crap? You know, and basically yells at Amy and walks out because the other young boys have come to the door to see what's going on, or the bedroom door. And he tells them to get the hell away and go to bed, and says to Kathy, you know, these kids of yours need some goddamn discipline, and walks out. And of course, Amy does say the little line, which I found really interesting, when she goes, Jody doesn't like George.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, yeah, well, do you blame her? like, you know, you this poor young girl, and she's a mental wreck, this poor babysitter. Yeah. And I completely
Let's call her Carly.
Let's call Carly. Everyone, it is not, her name is not Carly. I don't know what her name is, but we'll call her Carly because she was she was looking after Jack.
Yeah.
Further unexplained incidents occur when the two young boys suffer a crushed hand when a sash window falls on it, and Amy having an imaginary friend Jody, who seems to be of a malevolent nature. Yeah, this poor kid, the young boy. This scene is, even you went, oh my god, that was, because I already knew what this scene was going to happen. So the young girl, little girl Amy's downstairs outside, you know, playing with her dolls. And the two boys, being brothers, I'm sure, you know, brothers, little shits, yep, they've got a toy spider on a fishing line. And they're on the second floor window, and they're actually winding,
dangling this, it in her
dangling,
hair.
Dangling it down into her hair, so she keeps brushing something away. And she looks up and she goes, hey, you two, stop teasing, you know. Yeah. And now you got to remember that Jody is very defensive of Amy. So whatever happens to Amy, Jody's going to come and kick your ass.
Yep.
So, you know, they pull the fishing line or the fishing rod in the window just in time when Kathy walks in. Kathy's got this, what are you two doing? As if they've got
and
that.
They're like, on, nothing.
They've got this look like, we are angels. We're not doing a thing. But one of the boys has his hand outside the window, three quarters of the way out of the window.
They're just sitting on the window sash.
On the window sash, yeah. And this window comes down at a huge force,
yeah,
and basically slams his fingers between the window and the bottom part of the window.
And blood everywhere.
And blood everywhere. He's screaming at the top of his lungs. Now, at this stage, George has had a friend come to help him put a spotlight on a boat, and is also handing him some payroll that needs to be done. Him and George run upstairs to try and open up the window to get Mark's hand out of it.
So between the mother, the other brother, the dad, and the friend, they still can't get this window open.
Yeah, this window and as the guy was saying, it's like it's nailed shut. Like, yeah, they are pulling this window up to try and get rid of Mark, to pull Mark's hand out from this, and it's just not happening. They cannot get his hand out of there. They do, thank God, but of course, you know, they do find that luckily he's got no broken bones.
That is just impossible.
Yeah.
With the force that closed, he should have broken several bones.
Yeah, he should have. And even Kathy, that night when they come back from the hospital with Mark, she's laying there, and she's a mess. And she tries to wake George up and says, you know, don't you find it strange that he has no broken bones in his hand whatsoever? And of course, George is pretending to be asleep.
Yeah.
And I think at this stage, Kathy is really, really on. She's a nervous wreck. She needs to know what's going on. Now, one thing they didn't include in this movie is there was one night that George was saying that he was asleep and he was woken up. He always used to wake up at 3:15 in the morning. This one night he woke up at 3:15 and he looked on the side of the bed where Kathy was laying, and Kathy wasn't there because she was levitating above the bed.
Whoa.
She was actually a couple of feet off the bed.
That's
crazy. And George said he woke up, turned the bedroom light on, and actually physically had to get on the bed and try and pull Kathy back down on the bed. When she woke up, she had no recollection of what had actually happened. She just thought, like, George had turned the light on and was hugging her for some reason, but she had no, but George said that you were levitating. You were actually above the bed. She could never conclusively say that this actually happened, but George stated to the day that he died, and he died, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, that yes, this actually happened. 3:15 in the morning.
It's like that line from Ghostbusters. My wife sleeps above the covers. 2 feet above the covers.
Above the covers. She barks. She drools. She growls. Yeah. So at one stage, Kathy comes into Amy's room during the movie and says, because Kathy's hearing this song that Amy's singing, and it's a religious song. And it's a song that I wouldn't have actually thought any child would have actually known unless you were going to church quite a lot.
Well, did you also notice that it's the same song that her music box played? Her necklace music box played?
Yep, I always remembered that one.
Yeah.
but she's singing this song. And of course, so Kathy's standing at the door and listening to Amy sing this song and opens up the door. And of course, what you're seeing before she opens up the door is the rocking chair in front of where Amy's sitting, rocking backwards and forwards. So they're basically with each other. And Kathy walks in and goes, "What? Who are you singing to, princess?" And she goes, "Jodie." And she looks and Kathy puts her hand into the chair and goes, "Well, there's no one here, honey." And she goes, no, you scared her. She went out the window." And she said, "Oh, really?" So she goes towards the window and she sees these two red eyes in the second floor window. And you hear a growl. Like a growl, but it's like a pig grunt.
Yeah.
Because that's the way that she always came across to a lot of the family, was a pig. And you hear the grunt and then the red eyes disappear. Now, Kathy tried to explain to George a couple of scenes down the track that she thought that this was, I don't know what she thought.
It wasn't a cat.
It wasn't a cat. And of course, George is like, "But we've got ivy all up the side of the house. It could have crawled up there at any time." And she's like, "It wasn't a cat."
Cats don't do that. Hey, do we know if the DeFeos were religious?
Yes, they were.
Okay, yeah. So that is actually still a plausible part of the theory that it was like one of the dead DeFeo children.
It could have been. When Kathy and George bought the house, they did buy $400 worth. They actually put an extra $400 into the property to buy a lot of the DeFeo furniture.
Yeah.
Not the beds that they were shot on. Those mattresses were taken away, but the actual
frames
there. But when they first got there, George did say that around the house and for around the most part of the house, there was religious items of Mary and Jesus. There were statues basically all around the house.
Yeah, but it's interesting, though, that if it is the spirit of one of the DeFeo children, why it called itself Jodie and not by their own name?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there was no Jodie on any part of, I mean, there was no Jodie in the
yeah.
DeFeo children.
So I don't know. That's interesting.
So I don't know how it comes up with Jodie, but that's the way that Missy always used to say, because when I say Missy, her name's Amy, but they used to call her Missy.
Missy, yeah.
But she always used to say that it was this person called Jodie. Now she used to say it was just, it would change different shapes. So it wasn't necessarily a boy or a girl. It was sometimes a pig. It was sometimes a rag doll. But she always used to call it Jodie, you know, and this thing, but Kathy did get her to sit down one day and draw Jodie.
Yeah.
And she drew a picture of Jodie as a pig running in the snow.
Okay.
So it did actually show different forms to Missy, but it never conclusively gave a definitive "I'm a this and this is what I am." It gave it different little different ideas of what it was, you know. So, okay. So even the family dog Harry scratches obsessively, causing his paws to bleed at a brick wall in the basement. Now, this is something that was actually even more interesting as well, is that there was one night that Kathy and George were leaving to go out to a party. And this wasn't in the movie, unfortunately, but it's something to note. George, being in the military, he was always used to getting up at very weird hours of the day and night. And so the dog that he had was actually, before they actually got married, was named Harry. And George was always taking him to the base and whatever when he was in active duty. And so this dog was basically would get up at all hours of the day and night, you know, to go with him. There was one night, it was about 5:30 in the afternoon. It was still light out. George and Kathy were leaving the house. They went out the back door, closed the back door, and Harry was asleep. And George said Harry did never slept at that time of the day and was always basically on guard. So it was almost like this dog just wanted to be asleep and didn't want to deal with what was going on in the house.
Yeah.
But tried to go to sleep as quick as he possibly could. But George said that it was very, very strange this night, because he would always, at the slightest noise, the dog would be up and on alert, because Harry was actually originally a former military police dog.
Okay.
And he was...
Wow, that does not fit with the movie dog.
No. And he was getting close to the end of his time in the military, as far as the dog was. So he was basically to be retired. So George got very friendly with him and took him on as his own dog.
Yeah.
But George was always, you know, as I said, the dog was always on high alert because he was a military police dog.
Right.
But Harry, this one night, dead to the world, very, you know, it wasn't awake. George's land surveying business begins to suffer with his lack of attendance, and his business partner, Jeff, grows concerned. Jeff's wife, Carolyn, very sensitive to the paranormal, is both repulsed and intrigued by the things she feels when at the house. So this scene that we're talking about, her and Jeff pull up to the house because George hasn't been to the business in a number of days, and he needs to pay the men. And they did say, please go and deliver the payroll to George, put it in his hand, because we need these checks to be signed. So as they're driving up, everything's fine with Carolyn, but she goes walking towards the house and says, and she can't go any further.
Yeah, she's like, I ain't going in there.
And she's like, I can't go any further. It just gives me the creeps. And she goes back into the car, locks the door, and winds the window up. And it's because, as you said to me, she's a sensitive. She can feel there's something wrong. But then at another point in the movie, she can't get into that house quick enough.
Yeah.
Because originally...
it's drawing her.
Yeah. Originally, in folklore, what had actually happened was there was a guy called Ketchum that was supposedly a witch that was drummed out of Salem. And on that bit of land is where he built a house that was, he would incorporate devil worshipping, worshipping of animals, like sacrificing of animals and things like that. So what they're saying is this is the house that's put on the Ketchum site. So Carolyn cannot get fast enough into this house because she's saying that the actual room down in the basement, this red room, is where they come and go. Now, unfortunately, if you want me to tell you more about the red room doesn't exist. They did a tour through the house about 7 years ago, and the then current owners said, we'll show you the red room, and it was a closet. They opened up the closet and it was painted red. They said, well, they don't know why it was painted red. The previous owners had painted it red, but it wasn't a red room in the basement.
Oh, okay. I was going to say it wasn't the room under the stairs was in the movie.
The basement was a fully functioning basement. It had a living room. It had it was a fully decked out basement.
It amazes me that there's anybody who's willing to buy that house after all of this, after these two incidences.
Well, the thing is that, you know, this house has actually changed hands a couple of times, but we've never heard any more about anything strange or supernatural in that house. So this is where there's the idea of that it was a hoax because George and Kathy had overextended themselves financially to get into this house. But I still don't think that most people, if they want to try and pull off a hoax, can leave all their worldly possessions, because how many kids are going to sit there and go, yes, and you know, if it was today, yes, leave my Nintendo, leave my Xbox. Oh, I don't mind leaving all my stuff there. It's very hard. I mean, if you're going to try and pull off a hoax, you can do it and your wife can do it. But if you've got kids, they're the first ones that are going to break.
Yeah, totally.
They're the first ones that are going to sit there at some stage. Someone's going to come up to them and say, what happened in your house? And they'll sit there and go, oh, mummy and daddy said we should actually just tell a lie. Nothing happened.
But even so, with the DeFeo murders, it's still amazing that anybody would want to live there after something so horrible.
Well, I mean, you and I have gone ghost hunting, and how many, you know, and that's morbid to go into places where the criminally insane have been kept. It's the morbid fascination that we hold so interesting.
Yeah, but it's one thing to go ghost hunting for a couple of hours. It's something else to live with it.
Well, there are people that actually go and buy haunted houses supposedly to feel all this stuff.
Yeah, there are weirdos out there.
They really are. I mean, I'm not saying they're weirdos. I think it's just they're just really interested in that sort of thing. And as I said to you, living in a haunted situation for the years that I did, I wouldn't be going to do that. It wasn't my cup of tea. While in the basement, Carolyn begins demolishing a wall with a hammer, revealing a small room behind the wall. Discovering the damage, George takes down the rest of the wall, observing a small room with red walls. Carolyn, in terror, shrieks that they have found the passage to hell. Only her voice now sounds like Father Delaney's voice.
I didn't get Father Delaney.
I didn't get that. I didn't get Father Delaney.
I honestly thought it was like some kind of demonic thing.
That's what I thought. And I've watched this movie many, many times. I'm not saying hundreds, but I've watched this movie enough time to know about this movie, and I've never got that voice.
Mm-mm.
I've always thought that voice sounded like some sort of demonic spirit.
Yeah, I thought it was either some kind of demonic spirit or that she was channeling Ronald DeFeo.
Yeah, I never got Father Delaney.
No,
that didn't make sense. So if they're saying this is Father Delaney's voice, I didn't get that. But in this scene, you know, George comes downstairs, and of course she's breaking the wall with a pickaxe, and basically he says to her, what are you doing in my house? And of course, you know, Jeff's like, oh, I'm sorry, but she just has to do this. I don't know what she's doing. And George puts his hand to the wall and goes, oh yeah, hang on, there is something behind there, and starts breaking the wall apart. So Kathy comes downstairs and she's like, what the hell are you two? What are you all doing down here? And a couple of hits later, and you see this red room underneath the stairs. And that's when she does let out this shriek. Now, the scene that George looks into the room and sees his face reflecting back, apparently that was that he was supposed to see the face of Ronald DeFeo.
Yeah, because he supposedly looked just like him.
Yeah, but it wasn't conclusively proven that actually he saw that at all. Yeah. Because as I said, the basement was a finished basement in the house. And the red room was only a small room to the right-hand side of the main foyer, and it was a red door. It was a red room. So it was like a red closet.
Yeah.
So it, you know, and so I don't know. I mean, a lot of this movie you have to take with a pinch of salt and go, okay. Yeah. A lot of the stuff I'm sure did happen, but a lot of the stuff I think was embellished to make this movie more terrifying than it really was.
Yeah.
But I do think that sometimes, I mean, as I said, watching this at the nighttime with the lights off, yeah, it's scary as crap, and you know, that's fine. But sometimes it's like, yeah, come on, just give us some realism here.
Yeah.
But throughout the strange incidences, Kathy observes George persistence waking up at 3:15 a.m., feeling that he must go to check on the boathouse. And this was something that he always used to do. He said he couldn't tell anyone why he was going to do it, but he had to go and check the boathouse. So every night he would always get up with Harry. And a lot of the time he said he'd have to wake Harry up because Harry was dead to the world. And literally have to go to the boathouse and check. It was always the same as like checking the fire. He was just obsessed with checking the
boathouse. And then there was the night that he woke up and heard the marching band in the living room.
Yeah. Now that was something that he did say did actually happen. He woke up 3:15 and he said he could hear a marching band. And in the scene, you get the same thing. Wakes up at 3:15. There's a marching band. He goes out to the first floor and he hears it going on. He walks downstairs and it's still going, and he gets into the main living room and it stops.
Yeah.
Now the bite marks when he walks into the room and he trips over that statue, and it's like a dragon statue. Yeah. That was actually in the house of the Ronald DeFeo's house. I was right in the DeFeo house. It would move around from rooms to room. They couldn't figure out who was moving it. But he did actually have bite marks at one stage on his ankle.
Wow.
And he just tripped over it. So when you see that scene where he's got these three bite marks on the side, that was actually true.
Huh.
Kathy actually did come down and did actually check his ankle, because he said, I heard it, and there was three distinctive bite marks on his ankle. He couldn't actually work out how it actually happened. She also has nightmares in which she is given details about the killings of the previous family. Research at the library and county sheriff's office suggest that the house was built on top of a Chinook burial ground known as a satanic worshiper named John Ketchum had once lived on the land. She also discovers a news clipping about the DeFeo murders and notices Ronald DeFeo's striking resemblance to George.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really, and I think that was coming up to the, because they only stayed in the house 28 days.
Yeah.
This was coming up to the final part of the night, or the final part of the time that they were there. So she did have the, at one stage, they decided enough's enough. We are going to bless this house ourselves. So they went into the, and it was true, they went into the area where the, they'd hang a crucifix, and the crucifix was actually upside down and it was covered in black soot. So they cleaned it off and they went from room to room blessing the house. Of course, the spirits that were not interested in having any sort of religious thing did grab the crucifix out of George's hand. Kathy did go to grab the crucifix, and George said that she aged about 100 years. She became this little old lady, and she ran out of the room. It wasn't the fact that she was being attacked by George, which you saw in the last part of the movie at the end of the night, or the end of the 28 days. It was before that she went to grab.
It was interesting because I thought she looked so old there.
When he tackled her, that actually was around the wrong way.
Yeah, but I thought she, but it was interesting because I thought she looked so old there, and I'm just like, okay, it's got to be just the angle.
The way that she looked was the way that she actually looked when they were blessing the house.
Yeah.
And Kathy went to grab the crucifix, And that's when George said that she had aged 100 years.
Yeah, I think and that was an editing error.
Yeah, I think they did it around the wrong way. But the final night, which is the culmination of the 28 days that they were there, she'd gone to the library and found the newspaper clipping of when DeFeo, Ronald DeFeo was arrested, and it looked like George.
Mm-hmm.
So she races home. George, for some reason, we still don't know why he was nailing the window shut.
Yeah,
so I don't know whether the spirits had got to him and has decided that you're going to go and kill your family. But she races home. It's thunder, it's lightning, it's raining and pelting down. She runs into the house trying to find the children because I think she was going to get the kids out of the house now. She'd had enough.
Yeah.
All this stuff had happened, you know, between the smells, the toilet going crazy.
Well, and I think she was worried about him going off because she kept having the dreams about him opening her head with that axe.
Yeah, she did have a dream where she wakes up. In the dream, she wakes up. Alongside of her, George is not there. She goes into Amy's bedroom, and George is standing over her with an axe. He'd already killed Amy.
Yeah.
She yells at George. He walks towards her and puts an axe through her head.
Yeah.
She wakes up out of the dream to find George laying alongside of her asleep.
Yeah.
So she's getting these terrifying visions about what was going on. So I think after 28 days, she'd had it. So when she got back after seeing this newspaper clipping, she was trying to find the kids. And of course, at that stage, George, being incessant in checking the boathouse, was coming back to the house with an axe, looks up at the second floor and sees Jody in the window, this demonic red-eyed pig. He walks into the house. Now, I don't think he was in there to kill the children. I think he was trying to get the children out of there at this stage because he was walking around going, Amy. So I don't know whether he was just focusing in on her. I mean, he was definitely focusing on her.
Yeah,
but
by this point, Kathy had put the kids in the bathroom and told them to be quiet.
Yeah. But now I really don't believe that he was attempting to kill the children with an axe.
No, but I think she was starting to get irrational as well.
Yeah. But she does tackle him. He does throw her off and gets the axe and goes to bring it down on top of her,
mm-hmm.
and hits the floor right beside her. And basically says, don't hurt my children. And he said, you know, Kathy, I'd never hurt you.
Yeah.
Gets the children out of the bathroom. And of course, at this stage now, the house is falling apart. You've got blood oozing from the walls and from the stairs. In the real situation that happened, Kathy said there was also green slime that was coming down from the walls as well.
Yeah.
So she said there was blood, there was this green slime. They were walking down from the third floor down to the second floor, and as they were going past the sewing room, the door sprung open and there was a huge roar, as if there was a lion in there roaring at them. So in the movie, they go down the stairs, they're sliding through the blood trying to get out of the door. They go out and they get into the car and they drive off. And you're thinking to yourself, oh, okay, they're out of the house. Thank God. There's no more dramas that's going to happen. Except Amy does say,
where's the dog?
I want Harry. Where's the dog, basically? Now, as I said to you and as you agreed with me, if Oliver was in this situation, I'm sorry, I'm not leaving him there.
I'm not going to leave him at the mercy of those demons.
No, I'm going back to rescue my puppy.
Yeah.
So George stops the car in the middle of the street in the pouring rain, and runs back to Kathy yelling, George, no, don't go back.
Yeah.
George walks into the house and is calling, which you would do. You'd be at the front door going, puppy, come on, come this way. Poor old George then has to go to find the dog. Now, we all know where Harry's been for the last, I don't know, 20 scenes. He's in the basement scratching at the floor because of whatever is in that room or underneath the stairs. Harry is now at this stage at the top of the midway stairs, growling at this thing because obviously the spirits are coming out of this red room.
Right.
George,
well, they made it look like they're coming out of the floor of the basement. But
they are. So George goes to the basement door and opens up the door and goes, Harry, come on, boy. He walks down three steps and then falls right through the stairs and into the red room, and into this huge pile of black sludge. Now, Harry's already terrified about what's going on in this thing. So if you see this black thing coming out of the ground.
Now, did this actually happen?
No,
it didn't. Oh, okay.
No, unfortunately, it didn't.
Unfortunately. I wouldn't want to fall in that crap.
Yeah, what actually had happened was that in the final night, George and Kathy had left the house and they did forget Harry. Oh. George stopped the car, ran back, opened up the door, got into the house. The door slammed shut behind him. and George said he could hear a growling and something walking down the stairs. Luckily, George saw the dog. The dog was actually in the kitchen, grabbed the dog, and he actually broke out through the back door. Ran out into the car and drove away.
But he saved Harry. I'm glad to know that.
Yeah, Harry definitely came. But this movie was that he falls
a bit
into
more
a
dramatic.
He falls into a pit of black sludge while rescuing Harry. Of course, Harry is now growling and barking at this thing coming out of the black sludge, not knowing that it's actually George. He grabs a hold of his hand and starts to rip him apart. And of course, George is like, Harry, no, it's me. Harry realizes that shit, this is my master.
Daddy.
This is Daddy. So helps George to be pulled up out of this black sludge. You see them go up the stairs, go towards the front door, and the door slams shut. So George is now once again trapped in the house. You see the side window broken open from the living room, and George and Harry appear from the room. They run into the car, they get in the car and they drive away. And then, of course, you see a little, as the shot of the house and the rain and the thunder, you see a little caption that says, George and Kathy Lutz and their family never reclaimed their house or their personal belongings. Today they live in another state.
Now, I do find it interesting, though, that the entity in that house did not like George and did not want him there, but at the end tried to trap and keep him inside.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, you said that. I don't know what the whole scenario was of that, because if you really want to get rid of, someone in that, you'd probably get them out as quick as you can. I mean, this thing has already told a priest to get out.
Yeah.
Why would you, if you don't want the family? But I mean.
Yeah, I don't know.
As Amy said, Missy, Jodie wants us to live here forever and ever. So I think
it's wanted her anyway.
Yeah, so it's almost like selective. I want the family. But she doesn't like George, so
no. I want Amy. I don't care about the rest of you.
Yeah, but why would you keep George trapped? Well, it's almost like a last little, I'm gonna, trap you sort of situation.
Yeah. Well, if you're gonna have them leave me, then I'll trap you.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So, on saying that, we usually give a rating between 0 to 5 movie reels. 0 being where can I get the last 2 hours of my life back? To 5 being this movie was awesome and I will definitely watch it again. So. What would we give this movie, the home class movie chat? What would we give this one?
Probably about a 3.5 to 4.
3.5 to 4. It was just because there was a couple of things that we kind of thought.
Yeah, I mean, there was a few inconsistencies, and by and large, I just don't really like creepy ass movies.
Yeah, I know, but we did say that we were going to do some creepy ass movies.
but we do cover, overall. It was an interesting movie, but it wasn't a great movie.
No, I must say that the remake, the 2005 remake, was very disappointing. I mean, there were some legitimate jump scares in that one.
Yeah,
but
we weren't reviewing that one.
No, but I'm just saying that one, the house looked very, very different. It was just all over the place. This was the very first of many, many that they've actually tried to keep this franchise going.
Yeah.
I liked this movie simply because it was, as far as I could see, it was true to life and what had actually happened in the house. I've always enjoyed this movie, and I've watched this many, many times.
So what's your rating?
I'm going to give it definitely a 4.5. The only reason I'm only going to give it a 4.5 and not a 5 is because the house is not in the middle of nowhere. The house is right next to other people's, but I'm only going to give it a 4.5. I like the movie, and I would probably watch it maybe 2 or 3 times again this year. And it's, as I said, I've always enjoyed this movie, but I would only give it 4.5 because of some glaring inconsistencies and just some things that I wanted to see more of.
Okay.
The levitation would have been good to see if they had figured out how to do that one in 79.
The slap in the face would have been good.
The slap in the face would have been really good to see because that was something that really did happen. There were other things that didn't need to be in there, and the explanation of the woman's voice, I to this day, other than reading that in Wikipedia, to actually see that it was the supposed to be the voice of Father Delaney,
I never got it.
I never got that one as Father Delaney, so I'm sorry. Yeah. That's why I can only give it 4.5.
Yeah, because all right, fair enough.
They'd have said that voice was a demonic spirit, I would have sat there and gone, yep, I agree with that one, I'll go with that. But Father Delaney, no, didn't get it. And he never went blind. Sorry.
Okay. So that being said, thank you everyone for joining us. Please make sure to tell your friends all about the Home Class Movie Chat and to feel free to leave us a review on your favorite platform and reach out to us on social media at homeclassmoviechat.com and email us at hello@homeclassmoviechat.com and we'll see you next week. In the meantime, see you at the movies.
Thank you for joining us for the Home Class Movie Chat with Kat and Paul. Home Class Movie Chat is produced and edited by Create Your Change. If you would like to launch a podcast, please visit createyourchange.com.au. Please follow Home Class Movie Chat on social media and sign up for our newsletter at homeclassmoviechat.com so you can keep up with the latest news and promotions. We hope you enjoyed yourself today and will join us next time. If you did enjoy today's episode, please leave a review on the platform where you listen to this podcast. We'll